their seats. Maybe we'll get started. So I'm Ed McCord. I'm the director of the Gaston Segura Center for Asian Studies. This is our our annual lecture in honor of Gaston Segura. So first of all, I want to say something about Gaston. Originally received his PhD at the University of Michigan, which I always think is important because that's also my alma mater. And he's also in history, so there's two strikes in his favor. And then in 1972, came to direct the GW's Institute for Sino-Soviet Studies. In 1982, he was appointed by Ronald Reagan as Senior Director of Asian Studies on the National Security Council, and then later Special Assistant to the President on Asian Affairs. He returned briefly to GW, then went back again under President Reagan as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and where he played a particularly important role in U.S.-Japan relations, trade relations, and the democratization of Korea and other important areas. He continued on in that position for a short time under President George H.W. Bush, and then finally stepped down from his government positions in 1989, although he continued on as an advisor, returning to GW at that time, though. This is at the end of kind of the Cold War, where the original purpose of the Institute for Sino-Soviet Studies seemed less crucial to keep those two things together. So eventually the university decided to split the institute apart. One part of that is now our current Institute for European, Russian, Eurasian Studies, and the other part became our Center for Asian Studies. And so in honor of Gaston's contributions, both to GW and to the United States, the university decided to name the center after him, so it became the Gaston Segura Center for Asian Studies. He passed away in 1995, and it's our way, really, to honor Gaston for all his contributions to GW that we continue this annual lecture. And we're very pleased tonight to have Gaston's wife, Estelle Segura, and his son, Paul, here with us tonight. So I'm going to... And so for our speaker tonight, we're very pleased to have Dr. Su Qi, who's currently Senior Advisor for the President of the Republic of China and Chairman of the Taipei Forum, where they're doing all sorts of interesting stuff. He recently got his PhD from Columbia University, his MA from SAIS, and his, which I don't hold against you, and his BA from National Zhengzhou University. His previous positions included Secretary General of the National Security Council. He was also in the Legislative Yuan. He was a professor at Danjiang University. He was chairman of the Mainland Affairs Council of the Executive Yuan. So he's had lots of different, very important positions. And I think he's most known for his very creative efforts at trying to come up with frameworks for cross-strait dialogue. And his most recent effort is part of that, is trying to create a framework for kind of cross-party dialogue about cross-strait relations. So without further ado, I'll turn the podium over to Dr. Su.
Thank you, Ed, for your kind introduction, but also for your invitation. Ed tried to twist my arm for many, many months before we finally agreed to a date. And I'm really deeply honored also by the presence of Madame Segura and Paul. And I have a secret to tell. Everybody, a lot of people know that I graduated from SAIS, so I'm a proud graduate, but also Columbia. But one of my secret weapons is GW, George Washington University, because of its Sino-Soviet Center. And when I was student at SAIS, I told Ed and Deepa earlier, when I was a SAIS student, I came to GW often. I even took a course from Harold Hinton on Sino-Soviet. And there was a good collection of Sino-Soviet materials at George Washington, more so than at SAIS and then Columbia. So I did my dissertation, and I took advantage of the collection here. And finally, I get a chance to say thank you to the George Washington University for my dissertation. Ed asked me to talk about Taiwan. Well, all of you know very well, so I will have 1 hour, maybe speak for half an hour, and maybe we can discuss issues of some interest to you about Taiwan. But before I go on, let me share a true story with you. This was told to me by a good friend of mine. You know Jason Yuan. Some of you know he's he just stepped down as our National Security Council Secretary General, one of my successors. And he told me he was, at the end of 2008, after the U.S. presidential election, Obama became the new president, and someone in the Bush administration told Jason, and I should not reveal his name. He told Jason, and Jason told me, so it's a true story. He said, according to Jason, this gentleman, a former official, said, half jokingly, I'm sure, he said, if I, you know, that official, if I were asked by President Obama, by the incoming people, to brief President Obama, who at that time probably didn't know very much about China or Taiwan, he said, ask him to give to brief the new president-elect about China, it will probably take him 2 hours to explain everything, and Obama probably will get a good picture of what China was like. But to brief him on Taiwan, it would probably take me 5 hours. And I thought, wow, that was good. And that was my understanding, too. If, of course, China is not more complicated. But at that time, probably it was, I think it would probably take longer to explain to people what Taiwan was like. So fortunately, this is a very knowledgeable group, so I don't have to explain. I don't have to spend 5 hours. But let me briefly explain to you that what I feel about Taiwan situation right now. A little bit the background. I always feel that Taiwan is unique. Of course, everybody thinks of himself as unique. Taiwan's unique in the sense that we are situated in the neighborhood where we're surrounded by big powers. So Taiwan, historically, ethnically, linguistically, culturally, has always been part of China, but politically, Taiwan's destiny has been shaped always not by China, but by three big powers, U.S., China, and Japan. Hence, the picture is a lot more complicated than otherwise. And, China ceded Taiwan to Japan and recovered Taiwan after the World War II. And later on, during the Cold War, U.S. became the protector of Taiwan. Without U.S. support, Taiwan, I would be a communist. So this situation, what I think has a lot to do with the Taiwan's psychology, the fear factor, in my view, inside Taiwan politics among the people is stronger than in other societies. And this is one of the downsides of Taiwan's situation. The second downside, I give you three downsides and three upsides. The second downside is that Taiwan's economy is pretty strong. We are now number 23, perhaps. We used to be number 18 in the world. In terms of GDP, we're better than most of the European countries, except those West European countries. But we are dwarfed in the neighborhood by China, Japan, and of course U.S. and we're only better than the Philippines. And Taiwan is very lonely in the neighborhood. We don't have any natural ally in the neighborhood. Korea could go to IMF or World Bank if they have problem. Taiwan can go nowhere. So economically strong, but psychologically, diplomatically, we are very lonely, very isolated. That's another downside. The third downside is that strategically, Taiwan is quite important to China, Japan, and the U.S. So whatever we do at home or our foreign policy behavior has been closely watched by all the three capitals. Because of that, Taiwan's strategic room of maneuver is very small. And the room for mistakes is very small. I have always, during my services in government, I always remind myself that Taiwan policy, Taiwan government, has to be extra careful than other countries in the world because of this fact. Our room of maneuver is small. Room for mistake is very small. So we should always be careful and prudent and not to cause trouble for the neighbors. So this is the third downside. And there are also three upsides. Number one is that perhaps because of the situation, the situation I just described, the strategic and geographical situation, Taiwan has never experienced war. And major casualties. If you recall Second World War particularly, so many people perished in our neighborhood. China, some say 30 million people died during the Second World War. Japan, being an aggressor, lost 6-7 million. Korea, during the Korean War, and otherwise 3-4 million perhaps. Philippines, 2-3 million. I don't have the exact number. Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, everybody lost in the number of millions. Taiwan, 30,000. Japanese Imperial Army drafted 200,000 soldiers from Taiwan, mostly doing the cooking and the moving and the orderly thing, some engineering job. Not so much fighting soldiers. Set 70,000 return. So 30,000 lives were lost on the Taiwan side. And American bombers hit Taiwan several times. I don't have the numbers. I don't have the numbers, but I from what I know, the numbers, the casualty from U.S. bombing is not that great. In other words, during the Second World War, Taiwan was spared most of the damages. Taiwan was Japanese forward base, so Japanese even pumping a lot of resources into Taiwan. So Taiwan actually benefited from the Second World War, while everybody else suffered. And then Korean War and Vietnam War, again, Taiwan was spared. When U.S. decided to attack Japan, they attacked Philippines. Philippines lost a lot of people. Then attacked Okinawa, a lot of casualties, but Taiwan was spared. So in this, if you look at this way, Taiwan was quite lucky. Geographically, historically, and strategically, whatever happened to you. This is the upside. This is the upside, one of the three upsides. The second upside is that because of the strategic location, if Taiwan manages its relations well with these three big powers, Taiwan could well benefit from this strategic configuration. Taiwan being, we speak Chinese, many people speak English, and proportionally, more Taiwanese people speak Japanese fluently than any other country. Right now, I was told last year, I think, 60,000 people are studying Japanese in Taiwan. Proportionally, this is the largest in the world. And Taiwan, Japanese friends told me Taiwan is the only country in the world where they can have international conference in Japanese. So they feel very much at home. So this is, so it's unique. It's unique. So so if Taiwan and Korea, South Korea, which is situated similarly, but Korea doesn't have this benefit. So if we manage the relationship well among the three big powers, Taiwan could well benefit from this strategic location. Third upside is that strategically, because we are located this way, because of the strategic calculation, so even though our room of maneuver is small, mistake is smaller, but we could, at least people pay attention to us. So by the fact that people paying attention to us, like you're paying attention to me now, you know, we have some impact. Whatever we say counts. Whatever we do counts. So this is the third upside. And this combination, I think, has been at play for a long time to come. Those of you who have been managing relations with Taiwan, I'm sure understand this better than I do. So so out of this combination, what do we get in the historically? I think I would divide the past period into the period of underdog and the period of tail wagging two dogs. So for a long time after 1949, Taiwan has been underdog. China and the U.S. and Japan have basically determined what we were, what we could do. People don't. I mean, you understand China and U.S. Let me just give you quickly an example on Japan. I remember very well when I was a student. There was a time when, you know, those days, the Japanese economic influence on Taiwan was enormous. But Taiwan suffered trade deficits with Japan, enormous economic deficits. We made all the money from U.S., but we passed all the money to Japan. So at one time, the Minister of Economic Affairs decided that we should, he announced that, we should all boycott Japanese imports, otherwise we'll suffer too much deficit from Japan. And nobody listened to him. The deficit continued. So it just goes to show that Taiwan at that time was a small power, and Japan, it was pretty much at disposal of U.S., China, and Japan. And there's very little we could do to resist the power of the three countries. So that was the period of underdog. But then we're talking about TRA, 35 years of TRA. This year is the 35th anniversary. TRA was, in a way, was a turning point that in the fact that finally people settling down to the fact that okay, the U.S. has to follow the strategic rule, it has to make friends with the big power, and the little guy just put it aside, and. But then the little guy has to fend for itself. So Taiwan began to realize that we should not just rely on the U.S., but we should do something about ourselves. And that was a harsh awakening. And TRA kind of symbolized that. It protected Taiwan's, continued to protect Taiwan's security, but at the same time alerted Taiwan to the fact that we had to do something about ourselves. So Taiwan began to innovate, began to change things around. As far as I know,
Nancy Tucker's book and many others' book show that at that time, many people in the U.S. or in Taiwan were not at all confident that Taiwan would go on forever, like what we have seen in the last 35 years. I was a student here at CISO at Columbia, and very meager living allowance. I had a scholarship, tuition free, but I had to make a living. I can tell you right now, I waited on table. I help people move. I do all kinds of odd things. I cut the lawn, just to make small money to get by. That was a tough time, but we finally pulled through. How did we pull through? By doing two things. First, Jiang Jingguo began this creating new infrastructure in Taiwan. Nuclear power plants, ports, airfields, highways, superhighways, and that kind of thing. And then Li Denghui came along, democratization. So when China's economy was very poor and backward, Taiwan began the modernization. When China began to pick up with reform and opening, Taiwan switched to another track, to democratization. So Taiwan was always one step ahead of China. And by doing that, we survived. Everybody thought we would collapse, but Taiwan survived because we innovated, because we created something out of nothing. We experimented with democratization. No Chinese society has ever done that. So we survived because of the innovation. And then I think we moved into the second stage, broadly speaking. We moved from underdogs stage period to a stage what I call a tail wagging two dogs. A tail wagging two dogs, meaning tail Taiwan, two dogs US and China. So if you look at this period, 20 some years recently, Taiwan was actually taking all kinds of initiatives which would cause Washington and Beijing to react to Taiwan's initiatives. It began with Taiwan's opening to China. So the One China different interpretation was created by Taiwan. The fact that you're familiar with the Straits Exchange Foundation, SEF, Straits Exchange Foundation, Hai Ji Hui, and its counterpart, ARATS, Association of Relations Across Taiwan Strait. These two are what we call white gloves. They shake hands in the absence of the governments. So this mechanism was created by Taiwan, not by China. China hesitated for some time before they decided to come along. So Taiwan created the rationale for relationship. Taiwan created the bureaucratic mechanism for the relationship, for the new relationship. And then late in the year 2000, we created the 92 consensus. And when Ma Ying-jeou came along, we created no unification, no independence, no use of force. And Li Denghui created a states-to-states relationship. And Chen Shui-bian created one country on each side of Taiwan Strait. So Taiwan took all these initiatives, and sometimes these initiatives caused everybody trouble, big headaches, late-night phone calls, secret visits to Taiwan, the initiatives came from Taiwan side. Unlike in the old days, Taiwan had to follow the orders from the big powers. But now, in the recent two decades, Taiwan began to initiate things and wagging the dogs. On the positive side, now I would say Taiwan Strait is the only calm spot in East Asia. If you look north of Taiwan, you see troubles, you see turbulent waters. If you look at the south of Taiwan, you'll see even more turbulent waters. Taiwan Strait is the only calm spot. And that, thankfully, I think, because Taiwan's policy and China plays along, is for rapprochement. But on the negative side, when Taiwan takes initiatives which are tend to make trouble, Taiwan will be called troublemaker. So whether a troublemaker or whether a stabilizer, Taiwan makes a difference. Taiwan makes a difference by doing something or by not doing something. So the tail is not an underdog, it's but a tail which has some values. And this is the second period. I would argue, though, that we are probably entering to the third period, where now the dog is not going to let the tail to wag the dog. The dog wants to start wagging the tail. I mean China. So China, especially under Xi Jinping, is now more proactive than before. Zhang Zijun's visit, despite all the obstacles, is coming this week. It's not Taiwan's initiative. It's not Taiwan's initiative. And I think China is going to initiate more in the future. I don't know what, but I'm eagerly waiting to see. How come? Why? What are the factors that are moving us into the third stage? I see several factors here. One is that on the cross-strait issue, there are now two opposing trends, two opposing tendencies. One, subjective tendency is that it's in favor of Taiwan independence. As you all know, I see so many experts here. Taiwan's polls show the identity, Taiwan's identity is moving almost irreversibly toward Taiwan and away from China. I was born in Taiwan. My children born in Taiwan, even though my parents come from mainland. But I was born in Taiwan, and my children were born in Taiwan. I don't have the statistics. I would guess those who were born in the mainland now probably number no more than 1%. So overwhelming majority are born in Taiwan. So this sentiment and identity toward China is getting weaker and weaker. But at the same time, the opposing trend, the opposite trend, is objective trend, is moving further in favor of unification. I'm talking about balance of power. I don't need to remind you there are even better experts here than I ever was. The balance of power is moving in favor of unification and against Taiwan independence. So subjectively going this way, objectively going the opposite. Hence the tension. So the Beijing government and Taipei government and whichever party is in power will have to handle this, deal with contradiction and this tension. Thinking about this, I don't know why so many people are still trying to run for president. Because the job will get more difficult come 2016, whoever he or she is. So this is the first factor. The second factor is that in the last 6 years, Taiwan and China becoming more closely, more intimately integrated socially and economically. So red, blue, and green are coming into much closer contact than before. But right now we are seeing three sets of bilateral consensus, but there's still no trilateral consensus. Let me explain myself. There are three sets of bilateral consensus. So, for instance, between blue and green all agree that we should defend Taiwan. We should love Taiwan, we should defend Taiwan. The red is not. Blue and red agree, consensus, agree that we should oppose Taiwan independence. The green said no. The green and the red agree. Well, they don't agree. They never talked, but they kind of hope that we will all get rid of Republic of China. We don't want Republic of China. And KMT, the blue, does agree. So oddly enough, this bilateral consensus on three sides, but there's no trilateral consensus. Nothing emerging yet. So this is what I call a small triangle, blue, red, and green. The big triangle is U.S., China, Japan, U.S., China, Taiwan. That's the big triangle. Big triangle now is pretty stable. As I said, Taiwan Strait is probably the most stable area in East Asia. But the small triangle, the red, blue, and green, is not stable at all. And so many fingers are on the trigger. And we see more trigger-happy people, actors are emerging on the political scene, at least inside Taiwan. You know who I'm talking about. So this is destabilizing as we move on. This is destabilizing, and I'm worried. Third factor which worries me even more is that it's the Taiwan's domestic politics. The blue and green power struggle, it bothers me a lot. I know blue and red in the U.S., but in Taiwan, I can assure you, at least from where I stand, blue and green divide, rift is deeper. And at least in the U.S., I see President Obama and what's his name, the New Jersey governor, hugging each other, embracing. I see Speaker of the House and Obama talking to each other. But in Taiwan, the party leaders don't meet, they don't talk. Finally, 6 years into Ma's administration, finally Ma and the Su Zhenchang, chairman of DPP, met, but they pointed fingers at each other. And otherwise, they just don't talk. Even track two, they don't talk. And this worries me deeply. With the house so divided, how could we cope with the rising China? How could we cope with the strategic complex situation which is coming our way? So right now, for those of you who know our politics, DPP is practically trying to stop everything KMT does. So everything is hanging now in the LOY, Legislative Yuan, our parliament, nothing coming out of its door. And I'm sure with the election coming up, more bitter taste will, you know, the two sides will get into more with bitter struggles in the future. Even if DPP wins the next presidency, I'm pretty sure KMT would retaliate, given the mood. So vicious cycle will go on. Vicious cycle will go on. Blue and green forever. And this way, we keep, we're lucky we have this 3% growth each year, and China stay with 7%. I mean, it's simple statistics. In Taiwan, four provinces of China now surpass Taiwan in GDP. In the early 90s, Taiwan's GDP was probably one-third of the entire China. In year 2000, Taiwan's GDP was one-fourth of the entire China. When Ma Ying-jeou took office, Taiwan's GDP was probably one-tenth, roughly speaking, one-tenth of the entire China. And now it's probably one-fifteenth of the entire China. And in 2008 or 2007, Guangdong province finally passed Taiwan over. And after that, Jiangsu, after that, Shandong, after that, Zhejiang. And this year, I haven't seen the statistics, I mean 2013, I'm pretty sure Henan province will surpass Taiwan. So one province per year. And Taiwan still fighting each other at home. And no reform, major reforms have been undertaken inside Taiwan. So one time I wrote an article openly expressing pessimism and worry about the current situation. And I said President should undertake some reforms doing that. Otherwise, he would find that he works so hard, but he'll be like a squirrel in the cage. You know, you run, and when you stop, you're in the same place. Two, 3 days after that, I attended a dinner by President Ma. He gave a dinner to all the senior advisors, myself included, about a dozen. And he shook my hand. He said, "Oh, this morning," half jokingly, he said, "Oh, this morning, I look into the mirror, I saw a squirrel." So I knew he saw my article. I knew he saw my article. But again, sadly, things remain the same. So these days, I find it ironic that these days, I'm sure at least the people in the media know that Taiwan, they've been, you know, Chinese, one of the Taiwan Affairs Office spokesperson said the future of Taiwan should be decided by 1.3 billion people of the entire China. And Taiwan quickly, blue and green, quickly rebutted that, oh, Taiwan's future should be decided by Taiwan alone. But in my view, both missed the point. If Taiwan is fighting among itself, blue and green fighting among itself, the future, I don't know. The future will not be decided by Taiwan. I don't know decided by whom, but it will not be determined by Taiwan if Taiwan continue to fight among themselves. So this brought me to the five principles. And this analysis, this thinking, underwrites my you know, recent proposal about Greater One China Framework. The Greater One China Framework, this is the first time I openly speak about this, by the way. We held a press conference announcing this idea exactly a month ago. Ever since, I declined all the interviews, all the appearances in TV and whatever, because I don't want to be perceived as if I'm pushing any big project, that we are ambitious, we want to do this or do that, accomplish. No. I'm sharing with you now our thinking is, our first priority is to promote blue and green reconciliation. That's our first priority. And with this reconciliation, second step is to promote, hopefully bring about blue, green, and red dialogue, trilateral consensus, blue, green, and red. And this whole idea about Greater One China Framework, five principles, is merely an invitation to discussion. It's not a set menu. It's not a set menu that you can only order, no. It's an invitation to stir up the interest, to get people to think about this issue, to discuss the issue, and hopefully we all participate and come up with something which would be better for the small triangle. So you will find, I'll be happy to answer a question, you'll find, you know, the details, you will, blue and green and red, all of you will see something in that five principles, something you like and something you don't like. It's a mix, and deliberately made so. So I would urge you, don't be deterred by things you don't like, and let's try to look at something you like, and maybe we can, the blue and the green can sit down someday and talk about this. And so far, I'm encouraged by reaction. The best reaction would be for Beijing and Taipei, blue and green, officially to applaud it, to embrace it. But that's clearly not possible. It's such a short time. I'm encouraged by the fact that all three sides, Beijing, Ma Ying-jeou, and Tsai Ing-wen, all three sides remain open and neutral. Open and neutral. That's good enough. If Beijing quickly says yes, I'll be worried because the green would be suspicious. If the green says wonderful, Beijing would, what the hell? And if my angel says yes, likewise, the green would be suspicious. So it's very nice that nobody says great idea. And again, nobody chop it down. If either, I mean, one of the three said, this is not a good idea, this is no go, then it's a no go. But so far, nobody says anything negative about this idea, or positively. So this, to me, is the second best. To us, is the second best reaction we could ever had. And we hope that this invitation to discussion, as time goes on, will encourage more discussion and hopefully something will come of it. Because I see this year as probably the last window, this few months, I think, as we approach the end of this year, the election, the 71 election will heat up, and the next year, the presidential election will heat up. So Taiwan's politics will become, again, very too heated for rational discussion. This is why we put it out this time of the year. Okay, to conclude, quickly, I feel that Taiwan's democracy is still a valuable thing, but I think our democracy is in trouble. So I would, at home, I wrote a long article about, it was titled A Reflection of Taiwan Democracy. I think in the past decade or so, Taiwan has celebrated perhaps a little bit too much the success of our democracy. We have to admit that we have wars, we have flaws, which resulted in the current gridlock. Nothing gets done, which resulted in the fact that Taiwan's economic growth has been 3% in the last 12 years, averaging. Taiwan's economic performance, GDP-wise, is only better than Japan. We are behind everybody in East Asia. We're behind the Philippines, behind Malaysia, behind Vietnam, behind you name it, Thailand, Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, I mean, everybody. This is unbearable for me. I've seen good times. And I think the politics in Taiwan is really dragging the feet of our economic development. And we have to wake up and try to reform ourselves, try to stop patting ourselves on the back that we are doing well. And only by correcting our mistakes and the flaws, we can be a better beacon for people in China, inside China, who are voting, who are hoping for democracy. So that's my, I've been thinking about this. You can tell I used to be in cross-strait issues, spent a lot of time, but now I'm thinking that our cross-strait issues, our political, everything is held back by our domestic politics. So we have to do something about domestic politics. So I'm sorry, Ed, I took too much time and, you know, question, comments.
Are most welcome. Yes, thank you.
I actually want you to thank you for showing us you can explain Taiwan in less than 5 hours. That's all right. So I'll open up for questions, and I'll pick people, but I'll let you answer however you, stay here. Okay. Yeah. All right, questions.
Thanks, Suji, for an interesting conversation.
Everybody would identify yourself.
Sorry.
And you'll
I know.
Yeah, but not everyone. I'm Mike Fonte. I'm the director of the DPP's mission here in Washington. I've been at this a long time, not as long as you, but I've been at it a long time. And I guess I would take exception to Taiwan being lonely and isolated and abandoned. The TRA was meant to protect Taiwan. It was, of course, a congressional initiative. And I think over the years, if you ask the American friends, they think they've done an awful lot to keep Taiwan secure. So I guess I would really disagree with that first part of your analysis that Taiwan was out there by itself, needing to hang by itself. And then what has happened recently is also interesting, it seems to me, and something I'd like to hear you respond to, which is the rebalance. Where does Taiwan fit in the rebalance? It's my opinion that Taiwan fits in the rebalance where it wants to fit. And that could well be with the democratic nations of the region, with the United States, not against China, but within the framework of a U.S.-led rebalance. That's pretty dynamic and I think pretty important. We could talk about a lot of other things, blue-green divide. What about the democratic movement as revived by the Sunflower Movement? Seems to me there's been an injection of democracy through that mechanism. There are other points we could argue about, but I think the really key thing I'd like to say, and I'd love to hear your further comments on, is this U.S. role, because I think the U.S. is the one that has kept Taiwan free and will continue to do so if Taiwan wants it. Well, that's another question.
Should I answer or we wait for more questions? Okay. I'm glad you feel Taiwan is not isolated. But I'm pretty sure that's not a majority view in Taiwan. We do have friends. We do have important friends such as U.S. Without U.S. support, we wouldn't be here. But I think it's a fact that we are isolated internationally. With the number of international organizations we have membership, I think the number's less than Liechtenstein. You know where it is, I know where it is, but most people don't even know where it is. But that's the way it is. So if we have trouble, as I said, if we have trouble like South Korea did in 1997 or 2008, there's no place we could turn to. There's no place we could turn to. We have to self-help. Yeah. The second question is about democracy.
About the rebalance, I think that's the bigger problem. And democracy is a side issue. Another issue,
of course, about Taiwan's internal politics. You know that better than I, but it seems to me, I'm prejudiced here because I work for the DPP, of course, but it seems to me that there has begun to be wiggle room. And, of course, you have an interesting dynamic within the KMT between Wang Jinping and President Ma. So it's not like there's absolute blocks that are totally opposed to each other. It seems to me, with the student movement and they're going out and demanding accountability, you may be getting the beginnings maybe, of movement in the middle. That's a hope, I guess, more than analysis.
Yesterday, I gave a talk at Brookings about our Livayuan, our LY, and I made the point that I think the feud between President Ma and the Speaker Wang is at the root of the current stalemate. Not KMT-DPP. KMT-DPP, I think, it's important. KMT-DPP struggle is important, but I think if President Ma and Wang could patch up, of course, now it's beyond I think it's not likely. But if they could patch up, the DPP role would be reduced. And Sunflower Movement probably would not have taken place. That's my judgment. Yeah.
What the Sunflower Movement is about? Actually attended there. Cambridge and Harvard Squares.
Yeah.
And I could not get an answer.
Okay.
No, seriously.
What
is this movement about? For one thing, I did not learn what the compound word is.
I'm not the right person to answer. I'm too old. I could be their fathers or... it's just complex. I mean, several factors are at play. The young people are indeed very unhappy because of the job prospect, the low salary, which is for several years now. And the anti-China, the fear factor, anti-China, and they don't like Ma Ying-jeou. And but I think again, I think Ma and Wang, in my view, this is a hidden factor. And I think hidden factor, Chinese politics, in our politics, Oriental politics, there's always a yang side and inside. And after my experience in the politics, inside is always more powerful than yang side. So we scholars, I'm a scholar now, we all tend to analyze the yang side. But believe me, inside is more important, more powerful.
And they refuse to explain to me.
Because it's inside. Because it's hidden and it has to be remain hidden for some people, and unfortunately, I mean, I as I said, I run the personal risk by openly analyzing and pointing this out. Yeah.
Since we are kind of at the end of the conversation, I thought we're going to spend a little more time here.
Yes.
But we will take a series of questions, let you answer what you want to, and then okay. If still more hands, we'll do it again. So let's take a couple of questions.
Thank you. This is Jean Ng Nguyen, with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. Would you explain your vision regarding Taiwan's geopolitically impacts to the Southeast Asia, especially with ASEAN? You kept saying that Taiwan is lonely. I don't think so. I think Taiwan can have another innovations. It would be very important with all the islanders in the South China Sea, and including Hong Kong and all of us in China can have a very strong, very stable future if you can lead the stable prosperity developing there with democracy. So would you say more about your vision? It has to do with the rebalance as well.
Yeah.
Another question?
Okay.
So we're going to take a couple.
Okay, sure.
This is Anthony Chan from the University of Southern California. I'm very fascinated by the very pro-Japan Taiwanese psychology. So as far as I have observed, Taiwan and South Korea has both experienced over decades of colonization by Japan. But in a very different way, Taiwan was very, very pro-Japan while South Korea was turned out to be anti-Japan. So could you please explain more on the Taiwanese psychology on Japan? Thank you.
Okay, Southeast Asia, I totally agree with you. Taiwan should move closer to Southeast Asia and we should interact more. Until recently, during the Cold War, Taiwan was just consumed by struggle with China. And the U.S. was our only friend. So we paid attention only to U.S. and China. And to the neglect of Southeast Asia, not only Southeast Asia, even India. I led the first KMT delegation to visit India, the first ever in 50 years in 2005. So I totally agree with you. We should pay renewed attention to Southeast Asia, and our trade with Southeast Asia has increased so much that China is our number one trading partner. Southeast Asia is number two trading partner. Japan is number three. U.S. is number four. Yeah. So I also agree with you that either on democracy or on South China Sea, we could play some role. But South China Sea is more sensitive. Both U.S. And Southeast Asia and China, everybody's trying to nudge Taiwan on the Southeast Asia.
The 11 dash line came from Taiwan.
Yeah. But Taiwan so far, myself included, we are not in favor of changing the current position. Why? Because Taiwan feel this is not a right or wrong issue. It's a political interest issue, a national interest issue, because Taiwan has been barred from any discussion on South China Sea. Any. So we're never given a seat at the table, so why should we say something? So if we're given a seat at the table, we'll say something. Until that point, we just reiterate our current position, like it or not.
That was a suggestion.
If we change our current position, we will gain nothing. We'll lose everything one way or another, and we'll gain nothing.
So
we have to have something in return.
There was a suggestion that ASEAN asked Taiwan to come in. I thought there was.
We it remains to be seen. I'll see what happens. Yeah, but until that point, I don't see any point that we should change the current position. Yeah. Okay, Japan, yeah. Yes, Taiwan, relatively speaking, more so than South China Sea, we are pro-Japan because Japanese colonization experience in Taiwan is very different from South Korea. South Korea rebelled, more strongly against Japan, so Japan's suppression was harsher. But in Taiwan, it was not the case. The resistance was not as strong from the very beginning as South Korea. So Japanese suppression was not as bloody as in South Korea. And then because Japan tried to build Taiwan into a forward base into their advances into the Southeast Asia, so Japan actually pumped in a lot of manpower and money into Taiwan, build up the irrigation system inside Taiwan, the railroad, the infrastructure, the sugar company, the rice company, and dams, and all kinds of economic projects, and airports. Taiwan, the density of Taiwan's airports probably among the greatest in South Asia. I mean, if you look at our airports, the number of airports in the Taiwan's west coast, it's amazing. It's amazing. And not for domestic transportation inside Taiwan. It's for attacking, moving out to Southeast Asia. So Taiwan was turned into this. And we benefited from this Japanese colonization. So the experience is quite different.
Excuse me, but one of the phenomena that I observed from Taiwanese media is that I feel, especially the Green Party, they are trying to legitimize the Japanese colonization of Japan. And that's what I see. I would say it's kind of not only the historical legacy, but also the coastal colonial psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any
other?
Yes.
So, my name is
Zhao
Yuezhen, and My name is Zhao Jueqing. I'm a second year student at Hampshire College, and I want to ask you a question. So how does the moving piece of Hong Kong and the recent turbulence in Hong Kong play into your triangle theory?
I'm Janice Chen. I also work in the DPP office in Washington. And you touched a little bit on the proposal of the five principles that had been proposed a few weeks back for cross-strait relations, which you said was supposed to be a starting point for getting the three sides to talk. And as we understand, this was the product of collaboration from a range of former officials and academics and other thinkers. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how those five principles were formulated and, you know, whether those are, you said that, you know, it's not sort of a final proposal, it's just a conversation piece, so an invitation to conversation. So what kind of flexibility is there in some of the principles, or, you know, what are there any plans to continue to try to use that to get reach more of a point of consensus?
This whole idea began with Chairman Siminde. Yeah, he initiated, I didn't. He came to me, I didn't go to him. So we were neighbors, so we bumped into each other all the time, and we began to talk about things, and even though he's DPP, I'm KMT, but we began to talk about things, and we found that we share the same worries about, especially domestic, as I said, the blue and green power struggle. And so we decided to gather some other people into you know, more discussion. So the whole thing took, more than six months, with some people came in, went out. And the newspaper, I'm sure you read the newspaper, we originally, General Hao Bo-chun, the senior, he must be 94, still going very strong, swim every day, golfing twice a week, amazing for 94, I would be like him. Anyway, he agreed to join, and he agreed to all the five principles. But at the end, toward the end, he and General Hao and Chairman Si came to some kind of conflict over their analysis of the Sunflower Movement. And so he backed out at the last moment. So we had seven old men. Later we thought we it's too bad. We probably should have a woman. But anyway, the whole idea was not to, as I said, it's not to promote the five principles or whatever. The idea is to bring out, to show people that blue and green can actually agree on something so sensitive, politically sensitive. We can agree on something. So why don't we begin to talk about it? That's the whole idea. So it's not the five principles itself. Yeah.
First question.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question is about Hong Kong. Yes, Hong Kong. Yeah. Well, we pay attention to what's happening in Hong Kong, but unfortunately, Hong Kong is different from Taiwan, and at least I do not draw that much from the experience in Hong Kong. And PRC's handling of Hong Kong is also very different from their handling of Taiwan issue. It's very different. But this would factor into our calculation, because I think right now, in Xi Jinping's first term, there should be a good chance. Xi Jinping's second term, I see many experts here. Xi Jinping's second term, I will not be so sure. So you can tell from the sunflower movements, from other things, China has been, the reaction actually been softer toward Taiwan rather than harder and harsher toward Taiwan. But I think it will be his first term. His second term, I probably would expect something different, because second term, Xi Jinping would run into the 100th anniversary of establishment of the Chinese Communist Party, 2021, and 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Republic, 2019. So these two big anniversaries would fall on his watch. And he's a Taiwan hand, considered Taiwan hand. So his second term, I think he would be thinking about his legacy, he would be thinking about his report card, especially on Taiwan. Hu Jintao handed out a pretty good report card on Taiwan, one of the best bright spots on his record. But so Xi Jinping will not do less. So his second term, I think his strategy will be different. But his first term, right now, he's soft toward Taiwan, because Taiwan is a tough nut to crack. So he has to play out, use all kinds of tools, and he will start with the soft tools right now. And this is an opportunity for Taiwan, in my view. Yeah, come second term, it may be a little bit different. Hong Kong, as I said, Hong Kong plays a role, and Xinjiang plays a role, and because Xinjiang is in trouble, because Hong Kong is in trouble, and Taiwan's value goes up. You see? So I'm not surprised that Beijing is so harsh toward Hong Kong. Actually, I feel the more Hong Kong people show revolting against Beijing, Beijing probably would go stronger in order not to be to appear too weak. Yeah. But Taiwan is different. Taiwan is entirely different from Hong Kong. So their approach toward Taiwan is soft, moderate. Because Taiwan can, you know, Taiwan, as I said, Taiwan can make trouble. Yeah, Hong Kong cannot. So, yep.
And I'm afraid on that note, we really have run out of time. So I want to thank Dr. Su for being with us tonight, Chairman.
Yeah, thank you.